This is The Liminalist, the podcast between. This week I'm talking to Luke Dodson, the writer, blogger, and singer-songwriter. I just spoke to a chap called the unsayable, ungooglable Michelangelo yesterday, who described himself as a friend of Eric Davis. So, and a friend, of course, is a very loose term. It can mean any number of things. But anyway, so I didn't bring up the exchange with Eric, but I did bring up Eric and the thing around Kripal and Whitley Strieber. But have you read Prisoner Infinity, by the way?
Yes, I have, yeah.
Forgive me if you already said that. It's hard to keep track of
that's okay.
Who's read what. So for me, that's the kind of deep background I referred to. I guess you would have guessed that as far as, unless you didn't know that Eric PhD'd under Jeffrey Kripal. So Jeffrey Kripal was his, whatever the correct term for that is.
Supervisor, yeah. Academic supervisor, I guess.
Something like that, yeah. So, and then, so this is just giving me a bit more background. And then after Eric and I did that podcast that was the 200th Liminalist, it was right before his birthday, I realized that. So I sent him a copy of Seen and Not Seen just as a birthday thing, because I thought he might like it. And then I had the publishers send him Vice of Kings and Prisoner Infinity. His publisher sent me High Weirdness. And that was however long ago that was, must be a year now. So I was kind of hoping that he would read those books, of course, and then, you know, we could dialogue around them. I read High Weirdness. To be honest, I didn't have a great deal to say about High Weirdness, or that wouldn't be critical, even though I enjoyed reading it, because it focuses on McKenna and Robert Anton Wilson, both of whom I find a bit fishy now. Mm. Yeah. Philip K. Dick, I'm fine with. Anyway, that's just a bit of background. There's kind of unacknowledged or at least unaddressed areas of disagreement between us that are quite personal on both sides. Like, he's got a personal relationship with Jeffrey Kripal. I've got a personal relationship to trauma and the kind of things that Kripal is advocating. And so I feel quite strongly, as you could probably imagine, or you've read Prisoner Infinity, you know, I feel pretty strongly about some of the, what I see as the descent. Oh, and the other thing is American Cosmic as well. He had the author of American Cosmic on his podcast, and he didn't ask her any difficult questions. So, and I think that book is quite a deceptive book. It's the latest iteration of the UFO disclosure narrative.
Oh, I think, yeah, it rings a bell now. I think maybe you've written a blog post about it before. Not familiar with American Cosmic, but I tried reading Kripal's book on Esalen, and I can't really read his work. There's something about it that bugs me, really. There's something deeply just irritating about the way he writes, I find. And within the context of the stuff you were writing about in Prisoner of Infinity, there's something very dodgy going on there. And I don't know if he's fully conscious of it. I think I don't know him. I don't know anything about him other than his writing. But there's something, there's something untoward, I think, about his willingness to engage in a kind of spiritual bypassing regarding trauma. This sort of, I see it a lot, and because I'm sort of still connected with the psychedelic community through friends of mine, and I see the kinds of rhetoric that you see in that. the psychedelic world of this valorization of trauma and you know, there's no such thing as a bad trip, and the people who are continuously traumatizing themselves with their use of drugs, like just over and over again, and re-traumatizing and opening scars, and they manage to find this ideology, this framework whereby you can justify that as being, you know, your path of whatever it is, spiritual warrior, transcending the ego. And there's a particular very disturbing video that I saw that a friend of mine posted on a local kind of psychedelic based Facebook group of this guy called Octavio Rettig. I don't know if you've heard of this man.
No.
He's a, I think he's Mexican. He's a 5-MeO DMT advocate, and he wrote a book called The Toad of Dawn, which is a massive load of crap. I had a gander at it once, and just it struck me as like the sanctimonious bragging of a kind of stereotypical polyamorous burner douche bro. But in any case, this guy's been dosing people with 5-MeO DMT on a beach in, I think it's Mexico, and basically just bullying and tormenting and hounding them, and you know, pushing them down, dosing them when they don't want to be dosed, kicking them in the ass when they're on the floor in a state of complete disorientation. There was most people on the thread were saying, quite rightly, this is a horrific behavior and needs to be called out. But there was one chap who was kind of going, well, but you don't know, in 5 years' time he might have a totally different take on it. You can't see that it might be really beneficial for him and his spiritual. And thankfully everyone was piling on this guy and saying, no, just, you can't that's not that's not okay.
Does this guy, Octavio, does he have a philosophy behind his bullying? Is it spiritualized?
I think it is, yeah, I think it's this idea. I've again, I'm not really familiar with his philosophy at all, if he has one, but it seems to be this thing of 5-MeO DMT is this kind of tough sort of shamanic initiation experience that you have to take this warrior's mentality. And you know, he's got this guy doing push-ups on the beach while he's really tripping out. And yeah, and I've seen it in the drug scene. I've also seen it in kind of polyamorous sort of scenes as well, of people who are involved in these kind of communities getting themselves into very very difficult situations and justifying it through a kind of spiritual bypass. Not necessarily that in every case that's has to be like that, but seems to be quite common anyway.
And what's your familiarity with Eric Davis or your history with him or as a listener or a reader or what have you?
I've met him once or twice. I doubt he'd remember me. He might recognize my face vaguely from I met him at a breaking convention in 2017, in London. And he knows quite a few people I know as well, and he was present at sort of DMT ceremony with a friend of mine. And I when I met him, I found him to be a very likable guy, and I enjoyed reading High Weirdness. Though again, McKenna just. I just can't really be bothered with these days. It doesn't really interest me that much. Obviously, when I was big, sort of big tripper in my early 20s, I was quite keen on McKenna. Also quite keen on Robert Anton Wilson. I've
Me
got a,
too.
yeah. I just went through that sort of phase and that process, and got a little bit more time for Robert Anton Wilson these
Yeah,
days.
me too.
Yeah.
It's a spectrum.
Yeah.
Yeah, anyway.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. And Robert Anton Wilson, there's aspects of his kind of meta framework that I quite like, of this sort of retaining some doubt at all times about ideas, but at the same time, I mean, I read Cosmic Trigger because I hadn't read Cosmic Trigger when I was really into Robert Anton Wilson. I only read it after a few years had passed, and I kind of revisited him, and I read it probably about 2, 3 years ago now. And I didn't really find anything interesting or insightful that I can remember from it. It was just seemed to be lots of experiences he'd had that he used to justify this kind of transhumanist, proto-transhumanist ideology about life extension and living in space. And I mean, the one interesting bit in it was that I found out that Timothy Leary had advocated LSD as a quote unquote cure for homosexuality, which I thought was interesting, as it kind of gives a different angle on Leary from most of his probably contemporary advocates wouldn't particularly like
Right.
that view.
Yeah, that does seem to contradict his seeing himself as the reincarnation of Aleister Crowley, not literally, but the continuing that tradition of total sexual liberation, etc. Anyway, let's not get pulled off on a Leary sidetrack. And have you read other of Eric Davis, or are you a regular listener of The Expanding Mind, or how central has he been to your development?
He's kind of been around on the peripheries, but yeah, as I haven't encountered much of his work, I have to say. I've got a copy of High Weirdness, and yeah, I've enjoyed that, and I've seen a few of his talks. Found him to be quite a good speaker and very entertaining, but I was so he's there as a sort of an interesting coordinate that. I recall listening to the podcast you guys did, sort of coming up to about a year ago now, wasn't it? Or sometime last
It
summer.
was, yeah, it was June actually. I think his birthday must be around now again. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And it was interesting because there's certain key points at which there's certain key sort of topics on which I find myself sort of positioned somewhere in between you two. And the key one, I suppose, probably being psychedelics, where, or you know, sort of drugs generally. Whereas, sort of gradually, as I'm getting older, maybe drifting more towards your side of things, but still kind of in the middle in terms of the potential role of psychedelics in our culture. But I've definitely been. I'm definitely very open to the skeptical side of it, and many of my own experiences with them are kind of confirmed by that as well. The actual looking at the kind of paragons of the psychedelic culture that we see being held up, thinking about them in terms of just I was kind of going through a list of thinking about people who've writers and thinkers who remain quite influential for me, remain as people really I can sort of hold them up as right. Yeah, they've really pushed me along. There's not many of them come from the psychedelic world, to be honest, as such. Like not in the kind of classic, you've got your pantheon of sort of Timothy Leary, Lawrence McKenna, Alan.
Castaneda,
Yeah, Castaneda.
McKenna,
Yeah,
Don Lilly.
John C. Lilly, and this sort of these sorts of people. Aldous Huxley. Aldous Huxley is an interesting one, as I just don't quite know what to make of him, because there's something. So yeah, this was another, probably another in the background of something I was interested to talk to you about, was the complexity of Huxley's thought juxtaposed with his involvement with the Fabian Society and his kind of support of the ideas that were leading to the Brave New World that he was envisioning. And the way in which he was, you know, Brave New World can be read as a satire, and he described it as sometimes as a satire, but as a kind of almost an affectionate satire of sort of H.G. Wells and ideas of that he was himself promoting at the time of writing it. And his brother Julian at that time also being head of the British Eugenic Society, as well as then subsequently director of UNESCO, which is where my own family connection comes in, because J.B. Priestley also did some work for UNESCO.
Was that when you first reached out to me? It was talking about J.B. Priestley, wasn't it?
That's right, yeah, because I encountered your work on the now defunct Disinfo website,
Yeah,
disinfo.org.
whatever happened to that site, I don't know. Yeah.
I heard some rumors, but I can't remember exactly what the details were. It wasn't quite as juicy as I was hoping, but I don't know. But I was I, so I encountered your series Occult Yorkshire, which Vice of Kings grew out of, and then just reading down and then seeing a picture of my great grandfather there, and like, ah, this is something close to home. And then finding out that your grandfather and JB were associates and both involved in the 1941 committee, is that right? And the
That's
Commonwealth
that was
Party.
definitely one of the committees or groups that I identified. Yeah, I don't remember all the connections myself.
And particularly, I just, yeah, get back onto Huxley in a moment, but particularly sort of spine-chilling was the fact that what's it, the Albany Trust was founded, is named the Albany Trust because it's founded in the Albany, which was the location of my great grandfather's London flat. And he wasn't, I don't believe he was one of the founding members. I think that was probably his wife at the time, Jacquetta Hawkes, the archaeologist, who also incidentally was friends with Robert Graves, another sort of coordinate on the map there. But
Yeah, but just because people won't know the significance of Albany Trust, it was where the Pedophile Information Exchange had their first, where they set themselves up. Not that it was their base, but I mean, at one of the meetings there was where they came into existence, allegedly, yeah.
And in fairness and balance to the Albany Trust, I seem to remember finding a letter from an older member of the Albany Trust, kind of
Yeah, saying no.
fairly concerned about the involvement of this
Yeah, this is
paedophile in
not a good move,
Yeah, I'm just like, hang on, guys, maybe maybe back off
Slow
from
down. Let's slow down a bit. Let's
it.
stay with the gaze for now. Yeah.
And so that was that so that was my introduction to your work, and then from there I started looking into Priestley's connections with Huxley, which formed the basis of a talk that I gave at the 2017 Breaking Convention, where it was pretty neutral and kind of just sort of, here's these two guys, they were about at the same time, they were writing about some similar things, isn't that interesting? And then, but the comments section, the question and answer at the end, because I dropped some hints about Huxley's kind of ambivalent relationship to the ideas he was talking about in Brave New World. A lot of the questions, as I remember, went onto this issue of psychedelics and social control. And yeah, I was wondering, have you read Island, and what did you make of it?
It's been too long. I mean, I read many of Huxley's novels in my 20s because I liked them. I mean, I decided I read one and I liked it. It wasn't Brave New World, and I liked it enough to read the others. So I don't really remember anything about Ireland currently. It'd probably come back to me if.
Yeah, I have to say I've tried reading it. I've not been able to actually get through it, but I know that the general premise is that the background is he wrote it as a way of providing an alternative, a utopian alternative to the dystopia that
Right.
he was writing about in Brave New World, which he may have. Because it was a few decades after Brave New World. It may have been the result of some process of reflection on his ideas. And I know by that time he'd gone to California, had taken mescaline, got into the Vedanta Society, and started to espouse a kind of Kropotkinite sort of Gandhian socialism, Kropotkinite sort of view of small autonomous villages. And but in this particular instance of the island of Pala, I think it is, yeah, the society is essentially essentially, you could say, controlled. And my friend Rob actually made this point in the after my Breaking Convention talk on Huxley and Priestley, of saying that, even though it's portrayed as benign control, Huxley's vision of the island of Pala is essentially another society in which drugs are used to control people, but it's presented as being nice, because they take the moksha medicine, which is, I think, a compound derived from psilocybin mushrooms. Incidentally, I don't believe that there's any anthropological evidence for any use of this kind of psychedelic or hallucinogen in South Asian culture, or any kind of, because I think they're Buddhist. I think the island is supposed to be Buddhist. Cool. And I don't know of any. I'd be very surprised if there's any evidence of any widespread sort of social use of a hallucinogen in the way that it's presented in Ireland, in any kind of Asian Buddhist society. There'll definitely be examples of maybe a few, a kind of select cult of Buddhist monks partaking of some form of hallucinogen as part of ritual. But in terms of using it as a social, kind of social stabilizer, I don't know if there's any real evidence of that in Asia, and maybe to some degree in kind of Central American, South American indigenous cultures, possibly, but I'm not too familiar with that. But anyway, it seems to me that his portrayal of psychedelics in that novel is very contextual to him being an educated Westerner who got into Vedic or Vedantic spirituality, rather, and then took hallucinogens, and then they sort of confirmed that worldview for him.
So the 2017 convention, you were speaking there because you were Priestley's grandson. Was that your in?
That was basically it, yeah. So I
Mm.
was using the family connection as a sort of springboard. And I'd actually reignited an interest in Priestley after I'd seen another mutual contact of ours, which is Anthony Peake, speaking about Priestley at a talk in London in 2015.
Hmm.
Because at that time I was very keen on making my way in the decaying world of academia for reasons I now find bizarre and incomprehensible. I thought that it would be a great idea to try and capitalize on my family heritage to try and sort of secure some funding for a research project, which never materialized, and probably for the best. In fact, definitely for the best. But it was, yeah, it was seeing Anthony speaking about Priestley was the thing that sort of then around that time, is actually about the same time that I first stumbled on your work. So that's sort of late 2015.
Seems to be vindicated. I got a lot to sort through, and trust me, it ain't easy with a mind like mine. I feel their eyes fixed on me. I feel their eyes fixed on me. Fixed on me. I feel their eyes fixed on me. You know they're watching you. Everywhere you go, they're keeping track of your movements. You think it isn't true. You think I'm just a crank with a subversive agenda. I feel their eyes fixed on me. I feel their eyes fixed on me.
Did you come upon the Crucial Fiction site then around that time, or was it only when you read Prisoner Infinity that you've got to know that material?
I saw a little bit of the Crucial Fiction stuff. I think I read through that series of blog posts.
Because it was at the blog as well. I was thinking, I mean, there wasn't actually a website with PDFs, but I can't even remember how long that stayed up. Because it started in 2013. What became Prisoner Infinity started in 2013. And I mean, needless to say, I mean, it's there in the book. I think it really changed my worldview. I mean, the process of researching and writing Prisoner Infinity and obviously Vice of Kings and Occult Yorkshire. And in a way, they're like one book. Split into two, but in other ways they're not, because they're actually very different. But they're certainly mapping a single process, and even seen and not seen, although that's in many ways that's lighter. and more personal and personable. But anyway, what I was just thinking about, we were talking, because there's been so many specifics to get into, of course, or not to get into. And this whole thing of trying to map the landscape of the culture and the society and how it overlaps with conspiracy theory on the one hand, and kind of the flip side, a glorified or an idealized subculture on the other. And then somewhere in there you get somebody like Jan Irvin storms onto the scene and tries to make it really simple and black and white, as in it's all a conspiracy, essentially. It's all just micromanaged and mapped to sabotage us. It's no wonder that Jan has become a Christian, because this is like somebody like Charles Upton. I don't know if you're familiar with him at all, except through me. You are?
Yeah, I've read some of his writings, and I think I've listened to one of his podcasts that you did.
Yeah, well, I recommend The System of the Antichrist. He has a very sober and calm voice, and he's an elder in the true sense of the word, I'd say. He has wisdom. And he has, like I say, really, he has a view that's in some ways seems almost as categorically condemnatory of psychedelics and of the subculture and of the culture, like a unified conspiracy theory, as extreme as Jan Irving's. But he himself isn't, he's clearly not been pathologized by it, let's say. There seems to be a way to approach these things that we can end up becoming very obsessed and even possessed, and therefore kind of falling into the trap. I've said this before, C.S. Lewis kind of refers to it as well, but the trap of demons, metaphorical demons, please note, our listeners, they could be literal, is, you know, not just disbelieving them, but also obsessing over them. And so every time I talk about these subjects, whatever it is, Aldous Huxley, and we talk about Eric Davis as someone we both know, so it's much more tangible, I think, meatier, more interesting. I become aware of this part of me that wants to have an answer that's final and say, these guys were wrong, or they were part of this thing, and this is wrong, and this is why it's wrong. And of course, I know that doesn't work. It's not possible. This is why it's useful to know somebody like Eric, who I also liked a lot, and he seems like a good enough guy. I mean, that's just a seeming, obviously, that's just a personal thing, but he also seems quite intelligent, very intelligent and grounded, and there are many things about him which I'd say speak well of the psychedelic community in a certain sense, as in he's an exception to what I see in most cases of people advocating psychedelics. They seem unbalanced, on top of the fact that they're advocating psychedelics, if you see what I mean. Whereas with Eric, I find him unbalanced because he's advocating psychedelics, but I find him as a person seem quite rooted, so it does cause me to question my own certainty around that. Same with this chap I talked to yesterday, Michelangelo, liked him a lot, seemed like a very reasonable person, like I could very easily meet him halfway, and we did. But at the same time, I have this very strong feeling, and maybe it was there what you were saying about your response to Kripal. I mean, it's interesting to me, like even to Anthony Peake, because I knew him quite early on in his career, I suppose, because he contacted me about Matrix Warrior, how much he loved it. And actually, it took me a year to respond to that email. I don't remember how or why, but when I finally did, I found out his work, and I was really excited, and I met him on a couple of times, two different occasions at least, with two different partners I was with. So it was like he felt like there was going to be a close relationship there. But one thing I noticed about him very early on was that he was quite naive about the circles he was moving in and trying to ascend within. And this was before I'd done all the Prisoner of Infinity, made those discoveries. Even then, in those early days of knowing Anthony, I was aware of this, that he seems to be oblivious to the, let's say, the hidden presence of intelligence agencies behind so much in our world, including or especially the subcultures and the alternate perceptions and the different, what I call the second matrix, the different kind of remedies that are being offered to liberation, that the intelligence community is particularly interested in those, right? Not just in weaponizing them, but also creating counterfeits of them. And so there's a constant danger of being co-opted within that. Anyway, and I brought this up because even though I liked Anthony and I felt an affinity with him, it's not like we fell out, but we just, I just was not compatible with his trajectory.
Right.
And it's the same with Eric, pretty much. It's the same with, well, so many of these other characters. Like, even if I wanted them on my podcast, they wouldn't come. If they have a podcast, they won't invite me on their thing. And I don't think it's as straightforward as, so this is, we bring it to specifics with Eric. I mean, we cut to the chase. You know, part of my cognitive dissonance or the difficulty I have with Eric is I don't know, is he not what he seems to be, or is he compromised in a way that's mostly unconscious and just perfectly human, like he wants to succeed in what he's doing, and that he's found a niche, and that so he's learnt the lingo of that niche, and so he's, there are certain things that would be counterproductive to his advancement, and if he were to see them, that can be just very, very human, as compared to somebody who I feel this about Kripal, who is consciously aware of misrepresenting truth. I mean, because Esalen, come on, you get to, we can get to Esalen later, but this is, it's a very, very fishy thing, Esalen. I've got no doubt about that now, because I've even spoken directly to someone who has first-hand experience of being abused there. So it's super fishy. So to be the official biographer of Esalen and say that all that conspiracy stuff is just nonsense, there's no way that can pass for just benign ignorance, right? But with Eric, I'm not so sure, and I'll just finish the point, because I know I was a bit all over the place, that when trying to map, you know, who's legit and who isn't, or what's safe or what's true and what isn't, it's definitely not possible to just keep it to who's been infiltrated or who's been co-opted by intelligence community or whatever, because it's because it's not. And that so it's a much subtler thing. It's like, where is a person's allegiance? You know, what's their, I don't know, actually. I mean, where's the allegiance could mean a number of things, but it's like, what's the context that they have accepted for what they're doing? And I could say it's maybe the difference between a worldly context and a non-worldly, but I want to be careful about putting labels on it. But I think that the entheogen somehow represents a kind of visible pointer of that allegiance, because the entheogen, it's in the word, it's supposed to be something that fills you with God.
Yeah.
But it reduces God to an immanent principle only that is in physical matter, and that can be then be understood and reduced to DMT and the pineal gland or whatever it is. Jeffrey Kripal's supernatural is all about the soul, is electromagnetic, whatever it is. It's reducing everything to immanence. And so then our connection to God is purely there and in the worldly, you know, in a worldly power.
Yeah.
And that's the storming heaven thing.
Right.
And it's a hard thing for people to get, because storming heaven can seem like it's moral, or it can seem like it's all about passivity. There's a number of ways that it can be misunderstood. And maybe I don't, you know, maybe I don't understand it fully. But that's as close as I can get to trying to make this not about a literal co-opting, but about a much subtler kind of thing that is a spectrum, and it, I guess I want it to counteract this desire that I have to somehow, like, so we'll bring it, if we bring it to the specifics, I mean, I've been talking a lot, so you might have a whole other response, but with Eric Davison on that thread on Twitter, one of the things that was running behind my, you know, sort of behavior was, can I trust this person? Are they what they seem to be? How co-opted are they? How much are they serving some agenda that I consider unethical? And can I expose them? Which is not really a good, you know, way to approach a dialogue. Of course it isn't. But on the other hand, I can't just ignore it either. So, and I mean, I know that we're all on this spectrum anyway. Like, this is part of the Christian humility, that nobody is without sin. So, so anyway, I've said a lot, and it was a bit of a hot mess of different things. But feel free to respond at any time to any of that.
There's so many interesting, little points I would like to zoom in on there. So I guess as starting with Anthony, or Tony, as I generally call him when I see him, is that I maintain good contact with him. Like, he's a good bloke, you know. I consider him a mate of mine. And still sort of
didn't realize that. We'll give him my best anyway. Maybe he'll hear this. Yeah.
And in fact, I'm going to be speaking to him for a podcast thing in July, I think. And but because I knew he was writing about his latest book, is about sort of encounters with non-human entities, hidden universe. And back in August at the last Breaking Convention, it wasn't the last time I saw him, because I saw him more recently than that, but it was one of the last times I saw him. And I said, you know, have you read Jason's book about Whitley Strieber? And he went, no, like, you should really read it, man. Like, just, I'd recommend it. You should, it's, you know, I felt like it could provide some missing piece that maybe, it would be really interesting to see you guys have a podcast at some point, actually. Yeah. So,
I was supposed to do his podcast, but we got tangled up about the time, and it felt like Anthony got a bit pissed off, as I recall. And so we never rescheduled.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Fair enough. Yeah.
But I would be willing to talk to him. And it's definitely double if he ever read Prisoner Infinity. Because that, I mean, yet you're reminding me of there is more to my alienation from Anthony. It's that a series of books after we first knew each other seemed to me to be advocating too loosely things that I felt needed some closer scrutiny.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that I do have a bit of a hesitation about is this DMT thing. And there's just something about the valorization of DMT.
Yeah.
The spirit molecule, as Rick Strassman called it. And I've seen Rick Strassman give a Skype talk, and it was all over the place. I couldn't understand what the hell he was on about, to be honest. But in any case, that's a bit ad hominem. I've got nothing against him as a man. But with the DMT thing seems to be in various forms, like, you know, it's whether it's the smokable form, which my own experiences of it have just been like, it doesn't feel like the pathway to God for me. Like, I don't know where it's going. It doesn't feel like anything. For one thing, I was very alarmed and disappointed by about my experience with synthesized DMT was the the very digital nature of the experience. It felt very modern in a very jarring and disturbing way. It was like something I couldn't, can't really, never had any serious, what they call breakthrough experience of seeing the other side and going into the magical quantum elf lands or whatever it is. Never had that. But I did have a distinct sense of that there's a very different space with a very different geometry. It wasn't exactly hostile. It certainly wasn't particularly benign, but it also just didn't feel like, you know, it didn't have any spiritual quality. That it didn't even feel like fairyland, which is supposed to be kind of this kind of in-between zone. It's not really heaven or hell, they're not angels, but they're not quite demons. It didn't feel even like that, because there's something even about fairyland, the, you know, traditional fairy lore, that says something rooted and earthed, and sort of, you know, these beings that kind of live in the trees, and there's something kind of natural about them. They live in nature, whereas this just felt like my whole body just clenched up and was just going, nope, can't be here. Nope, this isn't good. Nope, can't do this. And then was a lot of shaking and sort of powerful energy rush in the body. That's been all of my experiences with DMT. I just don't understand how it's become. I don't understand why it's so popular. Mm-hmm. I don't understand how it's become this kind of god molecule. I suppose it is the extremity of the experience. But it just feels unsettling to me, you know, and it's something that would be interesting to actually raise with Anthony, because he's never done it.
You know, but he wrote a book about it.
He's written books about it, but he's never actually done it himself. So
would be a very precise example of writing books or advocating something that hasn't been submitted to sufficient scrutiny if he hasn't even tried it.
Yeah.
And he's advocating it. I mean, my sense is the books we're advocating.
Sort of, yeah. I mean, it's more just kind of bringing them into his broader hypothesis about the nature of, I'm sure you're very familiar with it,
the daemonic,
Eidolon dyad, and many aspects of which I have quite an intuitive kind of resonance with. We got onto Anthony Peak, we've got onto DMT, and the kind of, you were talking about the rendering of God as an immanent force, as a sort of molecule, or
reducing it to an immanent, and then how that allows for a physical conduit to God.
Yeah, which interestingly also can lead to the physical conduit can also end up being a source of disembodiment, as you've written about, which
is exactly that's the key, that's the context. Maybe that would have been a better way to put the context, not worldly versus otherworldly or whatever I said there, but bodily versus disembodied.
And talking about the kind of the scene of psychedelic advocacy and psychedelic culture and stuff, is that the people, I know quite a few people in it that I would regard as being quite sort of grounded and level-headed sort of advocates of, or, you know, maybe not even passive advocates, through thinking it's kind of okay and, you know, participating, but, you know, they would generally be the people on the ground or behind the scenes at these sorts of events. They wouldn't necessarily be, they might give a talk here and there, but they wouldn't necessarily be, you know, rock star psychedelic researcher, you know, hot from Stanford just come out with some new, you know, new bit of study about DMT in the brain or whatever it is, or many of the kind of lead advocates. And the last breaking convention I found really weird and very disturbing, with the particularly with the presence of Extinction Rebellion, and the kind of allegiance that the certain specific organizers within the Breaking Convention team have made with Extinction Rebellion. And yeah, and I know these people, and they're not wishing to name any names. The thing you were describing of like, how much are they sort of compromised? It's like, and there's a kind of ambivalence. I'm like, I'm not sure they're really, you know, this, you know, he's a really nice, friendly guy to talk to. But I'm like, hang on, what's your game? You know, there's one or two specific people, not sort of close friends of mine, but people I know on the peripheries that happy to sort of have a chat with, but at the same time, a little bit, yeah, I'm just not sure about where they're coming from. But yeah, there's a lot of very, very dodgy and disreputable people who are in the higher echelons of this scene. There's one that I've met that I find the one person in that scene that I actually find the most trustworthy from what I've seen, and the most interesting in terms of the things he talks about is probably Bruce Parry.
Don't know.
Did a TV show about tribes and about 10, 15 years ago. And he's kind of come out and said that actually, you know, I think psychedelics are interesting and great, but I don't think that important. And the most interesting state of consciousness that I experienced was living with hunter-gatherer tribes who didn't use any plant medicines at all and were just in this constant state of meditative embodied awareness of everything around them, because they had to be in order to stay alive, because that's, you know, that's the life of a forager. Mm. That I found very interesting. There's a guy called Darren Springer who I've always found just a very grounded and lucid speaker of these things. But then you've got, you know, on the other side, you've got people like, you know, Daniel Pinchback or, mm-hmm. you know, these kinds of extremely, extremely shady characters, and an awful lot of ego for a scene in which ego transcendence is extremely hip. And yeah, a lot of guru wannabes and, you know, all the usual shenanigans, really.
Trusted you. You seem the only one who understood my frustration. And now I'm on my own. I'm facing up alone against the gaze of the pyramid. I feel their eyes fixed on. Fixed on me. lost on me. Feel their eyes fixed on me.
I think there's, even in the term mind expansion, which is associated with psychedelics, and is seen as a, you know, as a legitimate goal, and maybe even, you know, synonymous with the goal to expand the mind infinitely to God consciousness. I think it's right there somehow in the danger of psychedelics. Well, it's twofold, I say. One is that they do harm to the body, which is even in Castaneda, and Castaneda remains the exception in all of these. You know, he's the only one of those figures that influenced me greatly that I still feel is really worth paying attention to the work. I think there's some enormous profundity in there, as opposed to those others that seem like emperors that were naked now. I don't feel that way about Castaneda, and whether it's significant that those are the works that also mention this fact that psychedelics harm the body, because you will not search high and low, you will not find anyone saying that in the community or acknowledging it or questioning whether it's possible. They might say there's no evidence for it. I don't actually care, because I've got my own body. I know I've got the evidence of my body. I know that they harm me. But anyway, that's the one downside. Now, many things harm our body, you could say, and life is, you know, living itself entails some sort of decay, so that's not an absolute disqualifier. But the other thing is that they do seem to boost the mind in such a way that it can start to conceive of unimaginable things, and kind of reconfigure itself in such a way that it starts to incorporate experiences that seem to be transcendental, even though they're sourced in something mundane, which is a plant, let's say, in its purest essence, but also synthesized things. So, I mean, I'm in a funny position, because I essentially I'm arguing that psychedelics are harmful and that they're not helpful. And yet, I really have a vested interest in not believing that, because I did so many. And yet, I feel as though I've got more of a vested interest in believing this. So why would I, if it wasn't true? I'll leave that as a question mark. I think it's mostly because it's true, and so I just really feel I need to own that. However, when I do look back on my own experiences, and I don't know how many you've had, but I must have had, I don't know, somewhere between, from around 40, 50 full-on intense psychedelic experiences, I would say, something like that, over a period of about 20 years or 15 years. Certainly, they showed me things that I'm glad I've seen, and they are, some of those experiences are useful as reference points. And I mean, recently on a Dave Oshana retreat, I realized, or it was, we became aware really collectively as a group, that there were several of us there that had dabbled quite a bit. I'd say I did more than dabble. In psychedelics, we were all sitting on the same part of the room, and there was a kind of affinity between us, and we'd all ended up there. And And so, of course, I can't say for sure if I hadn't taken those psychedelics, I wouldn't have ended up exactly where I needed to be. I can say that I'd be in better physical condition, and I'd probably be less... Well, I can't say I'd be less deluded, actually, because I could say that I would have been less deluded. I would have had a less delusional history. But I see, I feel that I'm less deluded now because I had so many powerful delusions. It was, you know, so powerful I acted them out, and I came a cropper. So I really got to see. So I can't actually be, you know, it seems to me that psychedelics are useful, but it seems to me that they're useful to take us to a place where, A, we don't need them anymore, and we know that.
Yeah.
And B, we realize that we didn't ever need them to begin with, or if we did, it was because we were just so off track. And this is in Castaneda too. I'm only giving you these things because you're stupid.
Mm.
And you're not going to actually see what I'm pointing at if I don't give you such a big shock that you're forced to stop telling yourself all this bullshit that's preventing you from seeing it. So I think there is something in that. Like, I really needed a really big shock to the system. And first of all, I learned about aspects of reality I had no idea were there. Now, whether they were psychic and, you know, just psychic and not spiritual, that's a whole other question. You know, maybe there were big delusions, like you say about the DMT thing. They're not angels, and they're not even fairies. They're maybe something else that isn't that transcendental. But it is amazing and astonishing, and it does open up, you know, our senses to the possibility that there's a whole hidden aspect of reality. That's one thing that, of course, I learned. But the other thing I learned over a longer period of time was how deep went my trauma, that it drove me into those things. Right? So there is something in that. Like, unless we act out our trauma and slowly become conscious that we're doing it, we might never even realize that we're traumatized. And I guess that's kind of a unified field theory of what I feel about these psychonauts, including somebody as seemingly solid as Eric Davis. I don't think they've really owned their trauma. I don't think they've really seen that they're still letting the trauma run their consciousness and their behaviors and their pursuits. And they're helping to create and expand this whole edifice of mind, this mental mind at large, second matrix, that's advocating trauma-based and re-traumatizing pursuits as a way to transcend the identity. Well, it only transcends in the sense that you go from a regressed part in the cowshed model to a progressed part. But you're still split. You're still split because they're not embodied by their nature. And the last thing I want to throw in here, because it keeps coming to me while we've been talking, is the transmission that Dave Asharma talks about is something that comes through the body, and how well we can tune into it in the body depends on how clear the body is of toxins, including trauma toxins and toxins that we just put into ourselves. And so if there's a fundamental baseline of existence that is transmitting through our bodies, that we receive and transmit it through our bodies, and that's the golden thread, that's the thing of value, then anything we put in our body to try and change our consciousness to access it it might give us a big taste of it, but it wouldn't actually be it, if you see what I mean, because it would be artificially induced. And actually we need to turn down the volume until we're like, I mean, maybe like that fellow with the tribe, although that sounded pretty intense, but just noticing that the most simple, subtle experience of being embodied and staying with that, you know, and it's boring. But compared to these, you know, it's actually kind of boring in a way. I mean, it isn't, because it's so delicious, but it's not delicious like, you know, a big bag of kettle chips is delicious. One has to start enjoying lettuce from the garden. I'm not there yet in that regard, right? But to be so sensitized to taste, that one tastes what's nutritious, one enjoys nutrition rather than flavour.
Yeah, I mean, even Alan Watts kind of hinted at something like what you were saying when he said, when you get the message, hang up the receiver. I don't know if he did.
Right. But,
in any case, you know, I found that a much... I preferred that... I've always preferred that motto. In fact, it was in my... One of my brother's last emails to me, he reworded it as when you get the... I think when you get the email, close down your account or something like that. As we were sort of discussing various transcendental kind of drug experiences and such like at that time. Mm. So I always had some time for that kind of dictum. And I thought that's a pretty good way to look at it. It also strikes me that maybe the whole way that we approach psychedelics in this culture is maybe causing this sort of, it's a bit of a misfire, because we've been conditioned to think of them as being gateways to a transcendental experience. And I don't know, I mean, they probably haven't been used exactly like that in many cultures that have used them. In those cultures that have used psychedelics, they have a very different take on them. So the, as I understand it, Mazatec, who, what's his name? The J.P. Morgan guy that went and...
The Wasson?
Yeah, that's it. Alden Wasson, I think? Yeah. The ones that he essentially stole their secret knowledge and then publicized it and ruined the community in the process, funded by MK Ultra in the process, that they never regarded the mushrooms as being this sort of gateway to God. It was a ritualistic thing, and it was a sacrament in a way, but it wasn't this kind of like blast away into transcendent bliss, heavenly bliss. It was much more kind of practical and down to earth. It was like, right, you've got an issue, you know, do the mushroom ceremony and you know, that will do its work. And then I'm really interested by what you were saying about they harm the body and your personal experiences of that. And with the Mazatecs using the mushrooms as medicine, I mean, a medicine is, you know, a poison if taken in the wrong dose or in the wrong, with the wrong contraindications. And so I wonder if that there is something that my hunch is at the moment, and my kind of sort of potted view of psychedelics is that we're a long way in our culture from establishing any kind of sensible relationship with them. And it could take, you know, many, many, many generations to even begin to start processing that. And we may not as well. We may find all kinds of, it may lead us down to all kinds of ridiculous paths. And the Aztecs took mushrooms and they told them to, you know, cut 10,000 hearts out every day, otherwise the sun wouldn't rise. So that's probably not a good result of mushrooms, depending on which way you look at things, but yeah, that doesn't sound too nice. But in any case, I feel that maybe we just need that time. And again, you know, what you were talking about of this just quieting down and slowing down and paying attention to things, and, you know, acquiring a taste for lettuce rather than, you know, kettle chips or whatever it is, that may be what's required here. And it also makes me think of the fact that people who talk about mushrooms in the psychedelic community usually talk about psilocybin mushrooms, but probably not many of them would be able to walk through a local woodland and identify
hmm.
some edible mushrooms, or there's some medicinal mushrooms, or some poisonous mushrooms that aren't those. And many of them would, because there are people who are into that sort of thing, and there's a definite crossover. But you know, plant medicines are all great, but you know, these days I'm more interested in actually learning just about plants generally, you know, edible plants and medicinal plants and trees and mushrooms and the actual, just the tangible web of stuff that's around us, of learning to just identify this wildflower, this this particular fungi, you know, whatever it is. And that the psychedelics have this kind of whiz bang flavor, but you know, I mean, could you know, you wouldn't want to eat a bunch of psilocybin mushrooms if you're hungry in the woodlands. You just want to find a, you know, a nice beefsteak or whatever it is. And
presumably that's, perhaps it's presuming too much, but possibly that's how humans first discovered psychedelic plants, because they were hungry and they ate something that had a weird effect.
Right? Nibbled it and went, oh, that's interesting. You know, wouldn't necessarily put it in a stew, but maybe save it for a special occasion or something. But there's, of course, there's the thing about ayahuasca, and ayahuasca is another thing I'm very wary of, and I've never taken it, and I never will, I don't think, and I find it very, when its presence in our culture to be very questionable. But there's the whole question of how these tribes identified that particular vine as going with this particular root. Mm. And maybe there was some, you know, sort of psychic intuition going on, but who knows? I mean, you know, it also could just be, it's be a random occurrence.
Mm-hmm. Well, my wife has talked about how she has had experiences of communicating with plants.
Hmm.
And she's very into the local fauna and recognizing edibles and trying new things and so on. So she's very in tune with what you're describing there. And occurred to me when you're speaking there that maybe eating psychedelics in order to have an experience of the plant spirit, if that's what's happening, is a predator's prerogative or default, like a default predatorial relationship. We're basically eating something to know what it's made of. Well, that's obviously changes the dynamic of the relationship, particularly if in the case of the Western psychonaut, I bet 99 times out of 100 or more, they haven't communicated with the plant before they ate it. Right? They don't actually know how to communicate. We don't actually know how to communicate with plants and receive wisdom from them in a one-on-one dialogue.
Mm.
But some plants, if we eat them, then we get it, right? But it's a bit like, if you go to see a tiger at the zoo, you're not really seeing a tiger. You're seeing something. You know, you're seeing a prisoner. You're seeing a captive.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's an exact parallel, but certainly, I think there's a whole mystery here. You know, like what happens through the symbiosis of the human and the plant, and how does that transform both? This came up in my conversation with Michelangelo yesterday. Because he was saying that the trade-off that I write about in The Serpent's Exchange can be benign, that we can receive wisdom from the... We can splice our DNA with the DNA of the plant and something new can come out of it. And that it's a two-way thing. Not only do the plants possess us, but our consciousness enters into the realm of the plants and some part of it will stay there. So there's this kind of free trade zone between us and the entheogens. And I think there's something in that, except well, maybe it wasn't an assumption, but, and certainly one can allow that might be possibly benign and productive. Well, I shouldn't rule it out, but Personally, I'm very, I've become very aware of how I'm not all here already, and how I've got far, you know, how parts of me have already been broken off and got trapped in different times in the past or realms, or, you know, who knows how that works, but parts of me haven't made it into my body, let's just put it that way, and how in that vacuum other things have interjected themselves, how my body's full of these foreign implants. So I'm definitely not inclined to want to mix it up with other things on the off chance that they're benign just because they're incredibly intense and weird and powerful. I mean, that just seems crazy to me now. I think about it. I want to get back to what it's like to actually be whole again before I even begin to decide whether there's any kind of, you know, benign way to splice our consciousness with other intelligences. It just seems as though we this whole psychedelic thing is a kind of crazy gonzo fools rushing in, you know, where angels just know you don't go there, you know? That's what it seems like the more we're talking about it. And yeah, I mean, I've tried to reduce it to something quite simple, like, well, you know, why would you try and use psychedelics to transform your consciousness if you haven't even resolved your own issues and so on and so forth? Because how would you know, what's driving you? But it's difficult, that, because of course psychonauts do, they're not, psychonautica isn't incompatible with psychotherapy or self-examination. They tend to go somewhat hand in hand. But it seems to me that the psychedelic spirit, and I guess it's back to your point about they can be used and maybe should only be used for this kind of deep psychological exploration and resolution. Because I think there's something in that. I think that give us access to the psychic realms and to the unconscious that we wouldn't normally have, and that certainly can be productive. But if we do it helter-skelter, and it isn't overseen by an elder who has resolved his or her issues and so really can guide us, we're absolutely bound to do it wrong and end up spiritual bypassing with this turbo boosted entheogen that lets us fly right over the trauma. And then of course that would be very compatible with the idea that, oh no, this isn't about psychic realms or trauma or ancestors, this is God, this is divine, this is absolute reality.
Yeah,
that would be the crucial fiction.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's this sort of the relationship with psychedelics and psychotherapy you mentioned, and kind of using them for deep work and this kind of thing. And I mean, in many cases, and you brought this up, I think it was in The Serpent's Promise, and that you brought up that actually, you know, are you going in, you ask the reader the question, are you going into these states because you want to bring back the magical trinkets of sort of, you know, poetic inspiration and music and whatever it is, stories that will kind of bedazzle and impress people. And it was like, I was just reading that, I was like, actually, yeah. In many cases, kind of. And I mean, I just sort of want to throw it out there and see what you think of this. I don't know. Is that always necessarily a bad thing? But at the same time, maybe that if we're just honest about that, maybe that instead of going, right, I'm going to take these psychedelics because I need to do some really crazy spiritual warrior work, and actually secretly what we want is some amazing, impressive story or poem or song.
Tales of power.
Yeah. Tales of power to sort of regale our, you know, female acquaintances with.
Right.
And
well, they probably wouldn't be too impressed, the female ones.
One can always hope. Yeah, is that, but maybe that there's, if there's a certain honesty there, I mean, there's a old bardic practices of spend, I don't think necessarily using entheogens, but spending the night on a burial mound to get to gain the gift of poetic inspiration, and nothing necessarily more than that. The poetic inspiration then would then be used for, you know, whatever the bard uses it for. But yeah, that's just some riffs that I've just thrown.
Well, that's a big question. Funny enough, I got it yesterday, or a suggestion from Michelangelo as well, so that's deja vu. But this time I feel I got something else from hearing it and thinking about it, which is that what's poetic inspiration, you see, and Blake wrote about this, and I was, you know, I came on the fence about Blake even recently and got into altercations over it, because I think that the higher aspect of the poetic inspiration, the idea of it anyway, the potential, and that Blake did write about, is for religious insight, as in for to become aware of reality, true reality. The things we bring back from that, but it wouldn't be a bringing back, perhaps. I mean, we'd have to qualify all kinds of things here, but maybe it wouldn't be a bringing back because it would be embodied the whole time, number one, so you wouldn't be going off into trance. But even if it was a kind of a journey somewhere and you come back, they wouldn't be trinkets, because they wouldn't be representations of your own interpretations of reality, your own fancy, or at least that element would be reduced. And that, so potentially they would be maps. Now I don't know if I don't, I mean, I suppose this is religious tradition, isn't it? It's revelation, actually. I was going to say, I don't know if you can map the higher dimensions. I said recently on YouTube, because somebody made the comment about one map of heaven is worth 1,000 maps of hell. I said, well, you can't map heaven, thank God. Because it seems to me, if we're talking about the infinite, then by definition, how do you represent the infinite? It's like the Jews and God. So I'm in danger of getting tangled up here, but that seems to be the question anyway, is, you know, if we have a transcendental experience, and of course we're questioning whether entheogens do give a transcendental experience first of all, can you represent it, and if so, is that useful to others? So the idea is you come back with something. This is a deeper knowledge of reality, and then you share that with others, and that maybe will help them to orient themselves and find their own experience of reality. That seems to me that's probably the tradition from out of which artistic self-expression came.
Yeah.
But we're in this degenerated version of it, I think, where it is very much like trinkets, where we wave around to impress the ladies and in the hope that we'll get laid. You know, it's become a currency, and that congruent with that seems to be that the representations represent less and less some kind of transcendental truth, and more our own psychic issues.
Yeah.
And that's where the honesty comes in, because I mean, certainly our artistic expression, not only I would say can, but should be self-therapeutic, should be a way to resolve things in one's own psyche, because if it isn't, what worth is it, essentially? And all the great, you know, the great art, even in our devolved times or whatever, Dostoevsky or Shakespeare, it's clear, unless Shakespeare was a whole group of Freemasons, we can't be sure there, but it seems as though somebody's working on, you know, some very deep psychological issues. And then that's, we get to see that. We get to see somebody, I mean, Dostoevsky's the best example for me, it's Crime and Punishment. Somebody's really wrestling with some very deep, you know, internal dilemmas.
Yeah.
And there's something useful or helpful for me at 20 anyway, when I read Crime and Punishment the first time. I found it useful and inspiring, but it's back to this, the entheogens, to resolve these psychological traumas that go, maybe they go so deep that they're ancestral, so maybe they do involve transcending our time-space continuum by going into psychic dimensions, but they're not truly transcendental, as in they don't give us access to the eternal.
Yeah, I think that's the distinction, I think, that has rarely been made that I've seen. As I've seen a few people within the contemporary sort of psychedelic scene that have made that.
There's
a guy called Jules Evans, who's at Queen Mary's University, has pointed that out, and that's where I got the stuff about the Mazatec from, actually. I think that feels intuitively to me like there's something to that. With art and artistic expression as being this thing of benefit for the tribe, as it were, then it does feel as though if you deal with your personal stuff in a productive way, it transcends the personal casing and becomes something universal. Whereas I think if, you know, in my own experience of having had numerous different creative endeavors of various different levels of my own perception of success, whether they get out there or not, it's just in terms of right, is that a good thing that's come out of me there? Is that good or is it crap, essentially? And, you know, the things that I've hit upon where I can look back on them and go, yeah, that holds together quite well, are those where it feels as though going into that, you know, that level of deep internal kind of turmoil or whatever it is that is provoking that situation or that artistic endeavor, coming out of it with something that's slightly beyond that personal thing. So there's almost something distant from me, or my perception of who I am. It's this other thing that's like, right, okay, that's now escaped into the world. Whereas the stuff that I've attempted to produce that has in theory been me working through my personal stuff, but in actuality has just been me kind of wallowing and ending up in a kind of chasing my own tail, really. That has not been, it doesn't seem to be artistically successful and would require some later tweaking often to actually be sort of like, okay, now I'm happy with that, you know.
Well, my dog's done bad.
No, I love singing too. But your song, it ain't sticking. You better change your tune. Well, we all have a purpose, and I found mine tonight. I'm gonna sing you out now. I'm gonna sing you out.
Very difficult balance to strike, actually, because I've written on both sides of that line there. I've written books that are not really at all personal, except you can't avoid putting yourself into them, but like the AOSK for Swans, let's say, that seem disembodied now and disconnected. Sort of like intellectual exercises. But then I also, during similar period, a period pre-seen and not seen, I attempted to write autobiographies and biographical fiction and so on, and I could never get it right. I could either not get it published, or I just couldn't do it to my own satisfaction. And so it's like, one is too egotistical, because it's like taking this disconnected, disembodied position of authority, and the other is too narcissistic. Either I'm an egomaniac or I'm a narcissist. So finding that middle way where I start to be able to use my own life experience as raw material. The way that a novelist, I suppose, a good novelist does use his own experience, I guess, and so I was never able to do that, but certainly novelists often use other people's life experience, right? They pick and choose, and they can, because they don't feel attached to it. So they can use it in this very dispassionate way. And I felt like I started to discover that way with Seen and Not Seen. And I suppose because it was once removed, because I was looking not at my life, but my previous writings and Blood Poets. Right. Like, who is this person who wrote that? And what was he trying to communicate? And what do I see now that I didn't see back then? And that was very interesting. And I think it facilitated that. I suppose spiritual things, they talk about the witness as a part of us that is living this experience, but it isn't identified with it. And so it can enjoy it. I guess it's pure enjoyment, as opposed to this constant back and forth when we're locked into the identification with the experience, where it's a roller coaster of pleasure, pain, we're just constantly trying to get out of the pain and chase the pleasure, and that whole thing that there's something about that creative process that allows me to tune into something that's actually always there, that is seeing my life as raw material to be transformed in some way. And that's happening anyway, I think. I don't know. I don't know how or why. Like, you could say God is, you know, if we could get into some poetic models about what's happening there transcendentally, but I think that we are, in some sense, processing experience for some other awareness, let's say, and that is happening, and so we can actually reproduce that and start to experience it as through the creative process. It's like a level down. We're doing the same thing. Oh, my, all my life experience, or this or that, is actually raw material, and I'm processing it now. And so it isn't so much the thing we create at the end of it. It's the perspective that we have to develop.
Yeah.
To do that processing.
It brought back a perspective that I was trying to work with my fictional endeavors about 8 or 9 years ago. You've sort of reminded me of that, brought it back, and kind of taking a whole new look at that, what you were saying about kind of recapitulating this observing principle through the creative process of observing at a certain remove. I don't know if you use those exact terms, but it's being able to view what's going on in your life as if it's sort of a work of art almost. And that, that was something that I was trying. That kind of something similar to that was an angle that I was trying a bit too hard to work with when I started writing fiction, and I've not really written fiction since that period, but it was after I started experimenting with acid and stuff like that. Acid and the writer Borges was the combo that kind of provoked me into that. And it was, I was essentially using writing as these kinds of this magical procedure of generating the changes in using my own life and then feeding it back into a kind of magical ritual that was the process of writing, that would be reorientate the world around me in some way. And the first time that I actually started experimenting with that, I didn't really know what it was I was trying, didn't fully know what it was I was trying to do, except the idea that I was trying to come back into control, essentially take authorship of my own life. And I wrote a short story about a paranoid conspiracy theorist who lives in Orpington, I think it was, who steals a postman's bike and then starts reading through these letters and finds a letter about himself, and then the story kind of develops from there. And that was something that my brother read the story. I wrote it a few months before he died. And the last phone conversation I had with him, he said, "Now your story changed reality somehow, and you have some kind of immense power, and use it wisely." And I was like, "Whoa, okay," and. Then after he died, I attempted to write a kind of fictionalization of the whole process of grieving for him, essentially, in essence, and attempted to create a sort of what seems to be now quite obviously product of a very wounded and childlike person in his sort of early to mid 20s, creating a kind of almost superhero fantasy around himself as a sort of like fictional barrier of armor against the cruelties of life, and that particular novel didn't go anywhere because it wasn't really me going into the trauma. Mm. It was me sort of trying to escape the trauma by turning it into a sort of occult conspiracy fiction, you know, in which there's lots of sort of reptilian bad guys and I'm kicking all of their asses and all this kind of thing.
Mm.
Sort of.
And how long ago was this?
So, that idea kind of germinated in sort of 2012. So it was all getting bound up also with the 2012 mania, which me and my brother were also kind of lightly dabbling in as well.
Right. So, and that was when he died, 2012?
2011. So he died October 2011. Another thing that came out of the last conversation I had with him was a kind of vague prophecy about something happening in 2012 that would involve maybe having to get out of the city, some sort of apocalyptic event. So yeah, he was kind of onto that, and it mentioned Grant Morrison's The Invisibles as well.
Mm-hmm.
Which is also sort of, yeah, lots of McKenna's ideas and Robert Anton Wilson and all these kinds of things splurged out into a kind of pop culture soup in the form of The Invisibles, which was really influential on me and presumably Toby as well, my brother. But again, it's another thing that I have a lot of reservations about now.
Particularly after seeing Grant Morrison's performance at a Disinfo convention or whatever that was.
Did you attend that? Because it's the infamous talk.
I didn't attend it. I've just seen it on.
Saw the video, yeah. It's the one where he introduces the talk by screaming and then says, "I'm coming up on drugs" or something.
Something like that, yeah. Because now I'm remembering that you mentioned your brother and his death in a recent email, and the context was the growing awareness of parallels between my life and your life. Is that right?
Mm.
So I do get quite a few of those emails, so that's why I'm maybe not 100% sure, because it does happen quite a lot.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that it's related to this larger, or the previous subject, which was about seeing our life as a story or as a work of art and as raw material for something else, that there may well be things that we're living out or working out collectively, and that would be these affinities that draw us to one another, because we are essentially in the same narrative.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, one of the the biggest parallel is obviously having both of us having lost an older brother who's, in your case, Seb was roughly sort of 4 or 5 years older than you.
Yes, right? Exactly. Yeah. Between 4 and 5, yeah.
Right, yeah. So pretty much the same with me and Toby. And as I understand it, I never realized this when he was alive, but Toby idolized Seb. Seb's persona,
yeah,
he presented was exactly the kind of persona that my brother found fascinating and I think wanted to embody himself, and sometimes kind of got away with it, but he was much more, I'd say, much more openly vulnerable than Seb.
So you're saying that you were aware of Sebastian before you were aware of me, then?
In a roundabout way, because, I mean, I wasn't fully aware of being aware of Seb. I didn't know his name, but I knew that there was... I remember seeing an advert for a documentary about him being crucified in the Philippines in the TV Guide or whatever. And I remembered that image. And then later found out, didn't realize that his name was Seb Horsley or anything. I just sort of remembered something about an artist who traveled to the Philippines to take part in this Catholic ceremony. And then when I discovered your writing, I mentioned it to a friend of mine, mutual friend of me and my brothers. And he said, oh, you know that Toby was obsessed with Sebastian Horsley. And I went, oh, right, I didn't know that. But I can imagine him being very drawn to Seb's character, the one that he presented to the outside world. And I suspect it must have been, he must have probably first heard about Seb through that documentary of the crucifixion.
I'm not actually sure if there is a documentary. I mean, clearly there's something, but somebody else, unless it was you earlier, mentioned a documentary about crucifixion, and I checked because I was not aware of any such thing, and I couldn't find anything. But there was a documentary that Sebastian was in, and then, of course, there have been, you know, the crucifixion has been referred to, but right. So I'm not entirely sure what it was that... Okay. What it is that you're referring to?
Yeah, it could be something else then. Maybe something else. Maybe an article in a magazine or a TV guide or something about it. I can't. Maybe that. Yeah. I can't quite remember it. Anyway, it's sort of surfaced in my memory as seeing a sort of little thing about something on TV about his participation in the crucifixion ritual.
Mm-hmm.
Something that's occurred to me recently about suicide generally, and looking at, you know, looking at your brother and my brother, and, you know, their paths towards sort of self-destruction and the general the prevalence of suicide,
mm-hmm.
specifically suicide, but also more broadly kind of self-destructive behavior in the modern world. And something that occurred to me recently was that my dad has a friend who traces the kind of history of the modern history of suicide back to the sorrows of young Werther.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, then suddenly this epidemic of copycat suicides across Europe, and that in his view this is sort of the origin of the modern suicide archetype almost. And it struck me that that came about round about the time that the Enlightenment and rationalism was developing and was gaining a lot of ground, and as a consequence, or maybe not necessarily as a consequence, but at the same time, the Christ myth was kind of collapsing. And it just occurred to me that what if the rise of suicide was in part at least an attempt to sort of bring to reintegrate the collapsed Christ myth.
Mm-hmm.
Now that the external savior who was martyred on the cross is somehow been compromised or emptied of meaning, or the institution surrounding it, or the dogma surrounding it, whatever it is, have become corrupt or no longer relevant, or whatever it is, but still this idea of the martyrdom and of the death that not only brings meaning to the individual life but to every life.
Mm-hmm.
Then there was this impulse to bring that into the self, and it got co-opted maybe, or distorted rather, into the process of suicide. So suicide is a kind of attempt to become a martyr oneself. And you know, I know that I remember my brother making kind of standing in the window in a white shirt and sort of making kind of ironic kind of Jesus gestures with his hands out like this when he was about 16 or so. And it's something that occurred to me. I remembered then also Seb's crucifixion also sprang to mind.
Who refers to him as Seb? I mean, where did you pick up that?
I think you must, maybe it was you, or...
No,
I wouldn't. No,
so I was wondering if you'd got it from somewhere in particular.
That's interesting. I can't. Someone must have referred to him as Seb rather than Sebastian.
Yeah, because he didn't. He didn't refer to himself.
All right.
The parallel there with between Christ and your brother and my brother, it's very obvious. I mean, he acted it out. Was one I zeroed in on or brought out in a recent blog post. Based on Dave O'Shaughnessy, the tormented artist, and but seeming like a kind of debased or distorted translation into the modern era or the postmodern era of the Christ archetype. You know, the artist who suffers for his sins and creates art out of his suffering. That whole thing, and of course the apotheosis of the tormented artist is the Vincent van Gogh, is the Kafka, is the suicidal artist. Another thing occurred to me here, which is kind of more mundane and just more up close and raw and personal. How did your brother actually die? How did he suicide? What were the means of his suicide?
He jumped off London Bridge, and
dramatic.
He was in a state of complete, like by the end he really wasn't in control at any level. He was completely delusional, and had a very, very sharp psychotic break, which nobody really saw coming at all. And it was induced or at least exacerbated by a few specific experiences he had with cannabis.
Oh.
And yeah.
Well, that's so, a whole other, I mean, it's bringing us back to the psychedelics, of course. But you would presume, even if you don't know for sure, that he would have been aware of Sebastian's death when it happened.
I should think so, yeah. And it's Sebastian passed away in sort of June?
June 2010.
Yeah. And this was a moment, and I think I might have mentioned this, sort of touched upon it briefly on a, one of my emails or comments or something, but that period was quite, that summer was quite a turning point in Toby's life. And I presume he would have been aware of Sebastian's death at that time. He probably would have seen word of it in the media.
If he idolized him, then he would have been, yeah.
But around that time, he was also, so his, an ex-girlfriend of his died in that summer as well, in a act that could be considered suicide. It was quite clear it was suicide or an accident. That occurred as he was severely ill from a bad reaction to a yellow fever vaccine that he took in order to make a trip to Tanzania to visit his then current girlfriend, who was volunteering there. And so this sort of collision of circumstances that happened that particular summer, that was might have been a month or two, maybe in July or August, but in that general kind of maelstrom of events of that summer, and subsequently it was around November of that year when he smoked some keef, and he had a kind of a mystical night terror, almost, of being fixed in his bed with a pressure on his chest, a classical nightmare. But it wasn't so much, don't remember him describing any sense of a presence or a demonic force. It was just that every breath he took would sort of create and collapse the universe. And he was really kind of freaked out by it, and he thought he was dead. And it seemed to be the catalyst for something changed in him at that point. But naive as I was, I assumed it was, would turn out for the best for him. Maybe it did in some way, but I wasn't imagining that. That's for sure. That I certainly wasn't imagining that it would turn out the way it did. And I sort of thought, oh yeah, he'll be all right. This is good. He'll integrate this experience, and he'll become much stronger and wiser as a result of it.
Spark and sing, rise among the
with trepidation you begin to tread. Ever so softly on these thorns of love, she would kiss you till you've tasted blood. Fall at her feet with brambles in your hair. Trepidation you begin to tread, ever so softly on these thorns of love. She won't kiss you till you've tasted blood. Fall at her feet with brambles and
well, what was occurring to me is when you brought up the Werther, even after I started thinking about, you know, the how when we hear about suicide, or the more that suicide is reported in the media, the more the rates of suicide tend to rise. That as mimetic as we are, we do imitate each other, and there's something about suicide that seems to be, maybe it's just because it's so easy to track, but there seems to be also that it's indicating a way out, obviously. I mean, whether it's really a way out, I would definitely question. I don't believe it is a way out, but it's a way out of something anyway, probably out of the frying pan into the fire, hopefully not literally. But this would go double anyway, as far as the relationship, the parasocial relationship between Toby and Sebastian, if Toby looked up to Sebastian. And although Sebastian, and there's a certain irony, Sebastian didn't actually suicide, he self-destructed one way or another, and there's three possibilities, and they're not mutually exclusive. One's suicide, one's murder, and the other is just is accident. I very much doubt it was conscious suicide, because he had a gun for that. It would take more courage to fire a gun, I suppose, so it's possible he would choose to suicide by heroin overdose. And the murder, well, if it was murder, it was his girlfriend, and I'm not saying it was, I'm just saying if, because I don't want to get sued for this podcast, and that would be very tantamount to self-destruction at that point, if you end up in a relationship that ends in some kind of murder, even if it's neglect, murder by neglect. But I say it's ironic because he preached suicide.
Right.
He said that the only honourable way out was suicide, because then you're calling the shots, kind of literally, because he used the analogy of when faced with the firing squad, the only honourable position is to give the command yourself. So he had this philosophy that when his time came, he would pull the switch on his life. And yet he didn't do it. It was a sloppy, messy death that was a congruence of all these different forces of unconsciousness that he just ended up self-destroying. And yet, despite the messiness of it, and this was one of the impetuses for Occult Yorkshire, really, or at least, yeah, it was, because it's there, and it's the end of Seen and Not Seen. You see the beginning of Occult Yorkshire, was me disgusted by not my brother's self-destruction, because that was just heartbreaking, but that it was celebrated in the culture, not widely, but there was at least one article which I knew represented an attitude saying he died the way he lived, and it was a glorious act, you know, it represented it was consistent with his life, and as if he died the way he would have wanted to die, because he died the way he lived. It was just complete garbage. And it was garbage because, you know, the way he died showed the pathology of the way he lived, or the despair and the agony of it.
Yeah.
Of course it did. Anyway, so it just seems as though, I mean, this is an amazingly intimate connection between us. Both our brothers died, self-destroyed, and my brother, both older than you and Toby by I don't know how much, not a whole generation by any means, but went first, and my brother's self-destruction in some way influenced Toby's unraveling. Based on what you said, I mean, I'm just hearing this for the first time, but if he looked up to Sebastian and he saw Sebastian self-destroying, I'm sure that didn't give him a message of hope.
Yeah, it's interesting. It hadn't occurred to me that there may be some some influence there as someone who he kind of idolized in some way or looked up to, as then, you know, there is, as you say, there is, you know, the Werther effect of the copycat suicides, or at least the sense of a self-destructive end to a life as being a glorious end, or something that almost, the way I sometimes see that suicide seems to be presented, or it seems to occur to us in the minds of those who are suicidal, as being a way of bringing meaning to a meaningless life.
Mm-hmm.
Your life has been completely just absurd up to that point. Then, you know, you can end it in a way that sort of, and it's off a lot of books and films and things do end with a suicide. And an example that's just full of bathos is the sort of popularly known as the worst film ever made, The Room.
Mm-hmm.
If you've ever seen it, but
yeah,
it's a film that's so bad that it's gained a cult following, and it's this very strange kind of Polish guy that financed this film himself, and it's all about a kind of love triangle that turns into essentially the main character kills himself at the end. And it seems to be like the main, he's kind of martyring himself, he's turning himself, it's you know, the way he's framed, he's got the sort of long black hair, and the way he kind of like collapses down onto the floor after he shoots himself, and then everyone's mourning for him after he dies, and you know, the bad woman who cheated on him gets her comeuppance, and it's always sort of brings this kind of tragic sense of closure to this film, but it is the kind of an illustration of the inherent ridiculousness of the idea of suicide. Is, you know, that this film is a complete mess. I mean, you know, it's like it's written by someone who has never experienced an actual one-to-one human interaction with anyone. They've only heard about it through hearsay, so the dialogue makes no sense. It's also the fact that his English is his second language makes it even more, kind of adds this element of surreality to it. But anyway, yeah.
Can I interject, or are you?
Yeah.
Well, it occurred to me that what you're describing is parallels there with the fiction and the reality, that it's kind of a last recourse of a bad writer is end on a suicide or a murder, because at least you've got the dramatic ending, and maybe the audience will forgive all the sins that led up there, because they'll feel the ending is powerful enough, right? And that the parallel is what you're saying about a person's life, if it's been chaotic and meaningless and disordered and seemingly futile, because they've had this consistent feeling of not being able to make their life the way that they want it to be, not being able to make it into a work of art, at least they can dictate the ending. In my brother's life it was, because he did live a bit of an archetypal life, as have I, in my way. And I mean, in obvious ways, he got crucified. Archetypal act of, you know, is it self-destructive? Is it redemptive? Is it both? And then his final days were following the play that was based on Dandy in the Underworld, and him seeing the play. In other words, seeing his life and his identity represented as fiction and finding it repellent, that was maybe that was, I mean, that was right before he self-destructed. So, and he made a joke about it. He said, "I'd rather be crucified than have to again than have to sit through that another time."
Mm.
And then he made the joke about when you see your doppelganger, you know it's your death is near. So there was this conscious level of something occurring there, which that he'd turned his life into fiction, and he didn't like it. So he had to end it. If you don't like your life, you suicide. But also, at least he could write the ending that he wanted. Right? If he'd failed to create the life he wanted to create, so at least he could create the ending. You know, it's this sophisticated rationalization for despair.
Yeah. Yeah, it just another thing that crops up from my memory is that Toby actually posted a status on Facebook a few months before he died in response to something that I think it was some kind of meme was going around, like what would your teenage self think of where you are now? And or something to that effect. And it was around the time of the riots were everywhere in London and all over the country at that point in 2011, as interestingly a similar situation.
Now,
so he was in Clapham, also visiting his girlfriend at the time, I won't say too much about her, but the places that he went to visit her tended to erupt in either civil unrest or led to some sort of, you know, powerful disease reaction to vaccinations or whatever. But anyway, yeah, it's another story. But in the context of that, all that stuff, so he was in Clapham, he wrote up this status saying, "Here I am at the age of 29, negotiating a taxi share from Clapham to my parents' house in Surrey, and I can hear my teenage self saying, 'Toby, you are a wanker.'" And a lot of people, well, not necessarily a lot of people, but one or two of his friends at least, after he died, commented on that status as being something that really spoke to them as indicating a lot of disappointment in his life at that point. And it had on paper, a fairly successful, you know, life and career, had worked in a really kind of trendy museum heritage consultancy firm for a number of years, and had done some, you know, high paid work there, and then was doing a PhD in Falmouth about the explorer Wilfred Thesiger, whose name I can never quite pronounce properly, but was a Middle East explorer, had been traveling around the Middle East, also in that time developed an interest in Sufism actually, and Sufi meditation, which may have destabilized him further as well, but certainly seemed to have an interesting life, and by the standards of our culture, an apparently successful one, but obviously not one that in general matched up to his, what he felt his teenage self would have thought of, you know, imagined how his ideal life would be at the age of 29. And then, yeah, in the end, he in a way took his life into his own hands, or some force did for him anyway. Certainly my mother was the last one of the family to see him alive, and you know, he was claiming not to recognize her, so he was in a very, very, very altered state.
Well, I feel as though we're not going to be able to end on a light note today. Not that I aim for that generally, but I'd say a particularly somber note. I say that because we've been on 2 hours and I feel I need to stretch my legs, and wouldn't mind staying on a bit longer if I felt we'd be able to kind of resolve or what, but I think not. I think we've opened up something that's bigger than either of us expected. Well, I can't speak for you, it's certainly bigger than I expected, because I hadn't picked up the clues that you'd left, that there was this much of an intimate connection between our ancestral lines, let's say.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah, yeah.
I'm sure that's, I'm not sure, but I imagine that may even be literal with the priestly connection. Of course, we all go back to the origin. You know, our ancestors all intersect if we go far enough back. But it seems as though you and I probably don't have to go very far back at all if you consider that, you know, our individual lives have so closely, have run so closely parallel before actually converging.
Yeah, definitely has opened up all kinds of avenues that I suppose I could have anticipated, but certainly more broader than I was expecting. Yeah, absolutely.
That's the end of my conversation with Luke Dodson. We're already planning to do another conversation because I really didn't get into some of Luke's expertise and knowledge and inside experience around the psychedelic scene and other areas of very underreported social engineering, skullduggeries and whatnot. So there should be a follow-up podcast with Luke within the coming weeks. 16 Maps of Hell is, I think, almost at £8,400, so around £400 now just for the hardback edition. Looks like we're on the home stretch, so give yourself a pat on the back if you've been supporting that. And I really think that this book is going to be my finest work. I think it's going to fulfill my own expectations or hopes anyway. I call it tragic non-fiction or non-fictional tragedy, which it just occurred to me anyway, I was working on it, that's what it is. And I don't know if it exists as a genre besides, you know, memoirs that are considered tragic, which this isn't. This is history as tragedy. Anyway, order it now if you haven't, because it's going to be a very limited run. Next week's podcast is with a Hollywood insider, kind of.